Fox News host Tucker Carlson recently said this.
White supremacy, that's the problem. This is a hoax. Just like the Russia hoax. It's a conspiracy theory used to divide the country and keep a hold on power. That's exactly what's going on.
Well, Tucker Carlson is demonstrably wrong. FBI statistics have long shown white supremacy is on the rise. The El Paso shooter wrote a manifesto. We saw Nazis march in Charlottesville. We've spoken to former white supremacists, or formers as they're called. And our next guest has spent more than 20 years studying them and why it's so hard for them to leave the movement. Peter Seamy teaches sociology at Chapman University in California. He's lead author, along with Kathleen Blee, Matthew DeMichel and Stephen Windisch, of a paper on white supremacy as an addiction. And he joins us now from Orange, California. So, Dr. Seamy, Peter, I want to start with, I can hear people saying, wait a minute, how can you compare evil and hate we're reading about? Take former supremacist Shane Johnson, who was featured in Mother Jones magazine. He would attack interracial couples, beat them near death in city parks. How can you compare him and hate to my loved one's substance abuse, which is a disease they can't control?
Yeah, and I think that that's a fair point. We're not saying this is the same thing as being addicted to heroin. The point is to try and better understand the power in terms of certain kinds of environments that people are exposed to, like Shane, especially over long periods of time in their lives where they're constantly and consistently exposed to hate-filled messages, rituals like cross and swastika burnings, music festivals. These kinds of things have an impact on how we see ourselves, how we see others, and even in terms of our neurophysiology. Our brain is impacted by the environments that we're exposed to. And so this might be in some ways comparable to what we're seeing in terms of some behavioral addictions like gambling. So it's be more in that realm than, say, heroin addiction.
Well, but you have studied brainwaves. You talk about neurophysiology, and you have seen parts of the brain light up in a white supremacist the way they might in an addict.
We have a very small pilot study that we completed. Our hope is to do a much larger study. But we did find in that small pilot study that former white supremacists responded differently than our control group in terms of being introduced to stimuli associated with white supremacy, different symbols and icons. And this suggests that, A, that they responded quicker to the images. And then in terms of the fMRI results, there were about six regions of the brain where they responded where it was different than the control group.
Well, but this all goes to why it's so hard for white supremacists to leave. And we know that from the formers that we've spoken with. It's very hard to do, first of all, because we keep staying with Shane Johnson, who did leave. His family and friends beat the whatever out of him. They almost killed him. But then he discovered, to his horror, that even though he was renouncing everything he'd been taught as a member of the Ku Klux Klan, he couldn't stop the thoughts.
Yeah. That's what we're hearing a lot in our interviews with over 100 former white supremacists. About two-thirds are describing experiences after they've left that involve kind of involuntary and unwanted, what we call residual, in terms of kind of a spillover from their days of involvement. And these are thoughts, feelings, and even sometimes behavior. We describe one incident with a woman at a fast food restaurant where she had ordered something through the drive-thru, feels like they got it wrong, parks the car, goes inside, and the employee that she's talking to is Latinx, and they get in an argument, and the former white supremacist, next thing she knows, she's using racial ethnic slurs, then she storms out and does a Nazi salute on her way out and yells white power, and by the time she gets to her car, she kind of comes to, and she's crying, and she feels awful and ashamed and can't believe what she just did. During the interview, she would repeatedly say, you know, I'm trying so hard to get rid of the hate, but it just won't go away. I can't get rid of it. Yeah. And so we're hearing a lot of that from the formers.
Talk about some of the other triggers. You talked to a former member of the American Nazi Party about white power music.
Music for many folks involved in this world is a very powerful attraction. It can be a major part of their entry into this world. And then while they're involved, it can be a real central organizing kind of social experience for them, where they come together with others at some of these music festivals, or even by themselves, they can play the music and realize that, hey, I'm part of a larger collective. And so it kind of helps them keep going. It kind of triggers, some in some cases, you know, really positive experiences that they, you know, had at the time in terms of being part of this social support system and having this solidarity and camaraderie.
Well, and back to Shane Johnson again. He was brought up in the Christian identity theology, in that everything, mm-hmm. you know, was filtered through that as from a KKK family. He completely rejected that, but then he couldn't pick up a Bible without reading it the way he'd been taught, and that would mean that Jews and African Americans don't have souls, or that God demanded their enslavement and extermination. I mean, you can find anything you want in the Bible, yeah. and that's what he'd been taught. Sure. These are the, you know, what you call residuals, which you also have in the addiction world. These thoughts and actions that can go on for years, even after someone's mm-hmm. disengaged from whatever the addiction was, in this case, extremism, they're involuntary. They just can't right. shake them. It's like reaching for a bottle. Tell us about the new thinking about, with this knowledge, how to help white supremacists leave.
One of the things we know is that separating the person from the group is really important, right? Whether they're connected online or offline to a group. But that alone isn't enough. And one of the things we do see is that sometimes people leave the group, but their beliefs really don't change much. And so one of the things we have to underscore is the idea that leaving the group's not enough. And then what do we do to help the person change those beliefs? And so intensive therapy that would help a person kind of reevaluate their beliefs and feelings is going to be an important yeah. piece of the kind of intervention model. It's not the only thing. And really kind of looking at it from that standpoint, I think, can be helpful in terms of being able to use kind of some best practices, including, you know, addiction studies, I think can be helpful.
Like formers who can encourage people who have just come out of white supremacy and who might be, you know, relapsing, to their shock. They have phone conversations. There's Facebook support groups. There's things that they can do to interact, because we're hearing that the worst thing that you can do to someone who's trying to come out of white supremacy is shame them and, you know, ban them. They need right. to engage.
So one of the things we know with absolute certainty that's important for people in terms of if we want to try and promote change, social support, right? Because their involvement in the group tends to provide that social support. And so if we can try and find replacements for that, that's essential. Otherwise, again, the person's more likely to kind of relapse back.
There's agencies like Possible, which is in Seattle. They have an app called We Counter Hate. They have technology that finds hateful tweets. And then they have former white supremacists, who interact with those hateful tweets, and it gives them something to do. But to somebody who is watching maybe someone they care about slip into yeah. white supremacy, how do you approach it? Because as we're hearing from all the formers, part of being a white supremacist, you are absolutely right.
So this does take some delicacy. We want to let a person know that we don't accept those beliefs, that we don't agree with those beliefs, but doing it in a way that doesn't condemn them as a person and isolate them so that they become even more entrenched in those beliefs. On the other hand, the compassion needs to be clear in the sense of that this is not something, you know, we agree with or we find acceptable. And I think this is something we can incorporate both at the individual kind of family level and also at the community level as well. So for instance, schools dealing with this issue can use this kind of an approach. Formers we've interviewed talk a lot about this process of starting to kind of question. You know, sometimes folks are vulnerable in terms of the violence. They may endorse the beliefs, but the violence that's associated with the beliefs may not be something they're fully on board with. And so if you can start to insert some seeds about, look, these beliefs and this violence, they go hand in hand. There's not one without the other, I think is a really potentially viable area where you could pretty effectively help kind of stem this, for at least for some portion of the individuals that are starting to become kind of attracted to extremism.
Well, and you also point out that when someone becomes a white supremacist, it's all in. It's every aspect of right. their life. It's everything.
Yeah. And that plays a big role in terms of the difficulties of leaving and the high levels of residual. When something is so centrally pervasive in your life and you're, you know, it's an entire lifestyle commitment, then, you know, moving on from that is really difficult.
Just fascinating. That's Peter Simme, professor of sociology at Chapman University, lead author on the paper Addicted to Hate, Identity Residual Among Former White Supremacists. Professor Simme, Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.